from Vision Australia Radio. It's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, I'm Michael Hintz, the velvety voice of Beano, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine. On where? Vision Australia Radio, of course, and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. And it's hello from my producer, looking $1 million today. Is that a haircut? Big investment, Tristan. Tristan Hodson. Today it's my pleasure to introduce two members, or masters, they're not members, they're masters of their respective crafts, the renowned chef Teague Ezard and winemaker extraordinaire, I was up all night learning how to spell that, Paul Bridgman, culinary, gastronomic and Venus collaborators who are busy bringing a new twist to dining and wining at Ezard at Levantine Hill. Where's that? In Coldstream in the Yarra Valley. The distinctive new restaurant, part of Elias and Colleen Gesserati's ritzy upmarket Napa Valley-like Levantine Hill estate, designed by architects Fender Castellides of Mona fame. Anyone been to Mona? Fantastic. This restaurant has a curved roof line replicating the undulating hills of the valley, spans of glass, eye-catching barrel-shaped tasting booths, and quality food and wine that's in keeping with the stunning design. Quite simply, first class. Just as Mona's owner David Walsh has created a unique and art and cultural experience at Mona, Teague and Paul have joined forces to create a memorable dining experience at Ezard at Levantine Hill. And I mean memorable for the right reasons. Gentlemen, welcome to Grapevine.
G'day, Michael.
Now, I trust a celebratory bottle or two of Levantine Hill has already winged its way to Michelle Payne for her stunning win in the Melbourne Cup. Along with an invitation to dine at Ezard at Levantine Hill, of course. And are Elias and Colleen into horses? Everybody is at this time of year, even those that aren't. Do you know?
I think they're more in the horse d'oeuvre variety.
Oh, yeah. Very good. T's got a good scriptwriter. And he's one of the staff thought of that.
I can't compete with that.
No, you just... Teague, Paul Teague, tell me, how did this collaborative venture come about? Who instigated it?
Well, I guess Paul was obviously sort of on the property, preparing all the vineyard and everything before I came into the fray. So, Paul, I'll let you answer that one.
Oh, thanks. Nice handball. I thought football season was finished.
Slippery ball.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure how that whole thing came about. I mean, I actually was trying to talk Ellie out of opening a restaurant. But obviously, that didn't quite eventuate. We find with Ellie that if you tell him not to do something...
So Ellie is
Elias.
Right, yeah. Yes.
If you tell him not to do something, I think that's, to him, that becomes the challenge.
Yeah, but have you got any kids?
I do not. I have a Jack Russell.
Oh, you have a Jack Russell. Well, if you have kids, that's the first thing you learn, if you wanted to. Anyway, yeah.
But certainly the focus... First and foremost was the wine, and this whole venture has been first about the wine, second about the wine, and then third, wine with food, mm-hmm. I guess. And I think the genesis of the whole project had to be finding someone with that sort of simpatico of that way of thinking, that food has to be the hero, but the wine has to be more the hero-er.
And food, and Teague is getting quite excited. He's bouncing up and down there. He's throwing his jacket off, and he's really into it.
Getting hot and sweaty.
Had you known one another or have heard of one another before all this?
Oh,
or were you complete strangers when you met?
I'd certainly heard of Teague and dined at his establishment before, but in terms of shaking the man's hand,
no.
Never before.
Mm. Yep. And what have you learnt about one another since you've been working together? That you can disclose on radio.
I must say, Paul is probably one of the most laid-back winemakers in the valley, probably the planet.
Is there a laid-back winemaker in the valley? Paul.
I don't see him in his own engine room, but I can say when I see him out of his engine room, he's very, very cool, very calm, relaxed.
Isn't he? Yeah.
Cool.
A musician. He's a musician. Yeah,
that's right. I think you use your guitar to make those grapes sort of stand to attention.
It's an extension of myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you've said, wine comes first. Tell us why this is unusual. What's different? Some people might think, well, this is a bit gimmicky, you know, because... But it isn't really. You're sort of deconstructing the wine and then you're building a menu around it, Teague. Tell me what exactly is involved in this. This is not just PR hype, is it? This is a serious thing that you guys have put a lot of time and effort into.
Yeah, look, it is. I mean, I guess what we're trying to sort of say here is what we're trying to achieve is that the food that we actually present is a great match for Paul's wine.
Yep.
So really, what we're trying to sort of really sort of, you know, knuckle down here is the fact that people can come and have a great wine and food matching experience rather than, let's say, a trained sommelier sort of running the room. And it's kind of, for a chef, it's kind of a reversal of the way you actually think about things. You don't have the support of a in-house sommelier that actually can sell a 400 wine list to each punter.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of work behind the scenes and actually getting each dish in readiness for Paul's vintage or a change of the wine list offer.
And they're
all featuring Levantine Hill wines.
Yep. For example, Paul, describe to us the flavour profile of this week's Wine of the Week, which is a 2013 Levantine Hill Estate Pinot Noir, alcohol by volume 13%, screw cap seal. Drink it until 2028, by which time I'll probably need to, as I'll be in my early 80s. Now, take us through this wine, Paul.
Well, this is a very refreshing expression of Pinot Noir for me. I think there's a little trend in modernity of going for quite sort of pretty, pristine, precise, and some might say punsy styles of Pinot Noir.
Very popular around cup time.
Well, definitely. But this reflection comes off our Maroondah Highway vineyard, which is where the Ezard Levantine Hill restaurant is sited.
Yep.
So it's a single vineyard wine, but it's sourced off four individual blocks off that. And so it's an assemblage of the various strengths of the different characteristics you get off various parts of the property. But it's very refreshing to me in that, having come from Yarra Yering to join this project, that the wines from there are quite bold and quite profound and very, very comfortable in their level of amplitude of how they express themselves. And so to come to Levantine Hill and find a Pinot Noir that just naturally expresses itself at the exuberant end of the scale, it's certainly not...
It's a perfect segue, isn't it?
For...
Well, you know, exuberance. coming from the wine you made before you came to Levantine Hill.
Yes. To have something that just sort of sits in the groove that I'm used to travelling in.
Yep.
And it's not a shrinking violet. And
obviously not.
I think that also throws an extra challenge onto Teague and Sean in when you've got such kind of expression, unbridled expression, to be able to, I think, work in synergy with that, and neither the food nor the wine should be dominating of the other, and finding that sort of sympathetic kind of togetherness between the food and the wine. And then that's the ethos behind the whole venture, is not just wine for wine's sake. Certainly our wines, if you drink them in isolation, they'll get you where you want to go. But the real beauty behind the venture is that European focus of food friendliness, conviviality, sharing plates, sharing food, sharing good times, and the wine and the food are completely paramount of importance in getting that.
All right, we've opened the batting with Levantine Hill. So, Teague, what's your perfect food match for this wine? Is it I believe it's a pork dish, isn't it?
So we're talking about the 13 or the current vintage?
No, the 13.
Yeah, okay. So the 13... Look, there was a pork dish on, and I think we sort of changed that around a little bit. But yeah, the current pork belly dish does have it's a crispy skin pork belly, so it's cooked in a stock for a number of hours, 53 degrees, just finished off, crispy skin. It's served with we just changed it from a Jerusalem artichoke puree and had some local Yarra Valley chestnuts and a red wine jam. So
And garlic and golden raisins. Did you have that?
Garlic and golden raisins. Yep. So what we try and do is we obviously with that particular dish, we really hone in on Paul's mind, his brain, his tasting notes, and we try.
It's a scary
and
place.
Try and, I've been there. He's right. And so what we try is we try and get in there and actually try and pull out so those key notes of each wine, and then try and implement those as part of the garnish or as part of the overall landscape of each dish.
So it'd be easy to, I know what most people now are listening to this are busy preparing dinner on Saturday night, and they'd have been thinking, well, hands up all of you at home that thought the food was going to go with the pinot was going to be duck. Well, wrong. See, that's too obvious. Now, let's go through a few of these wines, and we'll do the food match because this is the essence of why we're here today. Paul, as I list each one, please describe briefly the style of wine you're aiming to achieve, and then T, you can describe the food match. Mm. Now, I'm going to start with the 2014 Levantine Hill Estate Melange. I've been practicing that. Notice the Melange. Traditional Blanc. Now, take us through that, Paul. What's that wine all about?
Well, it's named the Melange Traditionnel Blanc, which... for those who aren't as fluent in French as myself and Michael have proven to be, it is a traditional white blend, so based on the white wines of Bordeaux in particular. So it's a Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon blend predominantly. However, they do include an aromatic third white varietal generally, which is normally a Muscadel.
Muscadel, yeah.
With this one, we've planted Muscadel at the Marunda Highway Vineyard, but it's still a year or two away from fruiting. So we've snuck in a cheeky little dollop of a white grape called Viognier.
Oh, Viognier, oh, yes.
So, which is generally a pretty appealing.
That goes
very
into
aromatic.
Some reds, doesn't it?
It can go into some reds, but it's one of those things, a little bit goes a long way.
My word.
And sort of much like what happens with Teague and his cooking is some of the little elements on the side of the dish are actually as important as the main focus or the protein or whatever that's going into the dish. And so when we're constructing and deconstructing flavours and that sort of thing and putting dishes together, it's the little garnish and the little eye catches that appear on the side can be as important to the overall balance of not just the meal but the wine that goes with it.
Yeah, there's a book out called The Perfect Meal which goes into this. I think that the meal is much more than just, it's the plating, it's the atmosphere, it's the crockery, cutlery, it's all the elements, the whole experience that go into this, isn't it, Teague? It's not just the food.
Oh, look, that's right. I mean, it's a whole experience because having said that, this is a degustation only menu.
Yep.
So it's important that what we do is we capture in each particular dish, a fair bit of wow factor or some sizzle.
Yeah.
And we just like to sort of keep the, amp it up and to maintain, I think, that... that sort of Ezard sort of way of we sort of come together with our sort of sour, salty, crispy, luxurious sort of textures together. So it's a it's important to get that right from the go-get.
Yeah. Now and with this white wine, white blend, Bordeaux blend, you I believe are going to serve or have served some ocean trout.
Yes.
And with an apple ouzu gel.
Yes.
Radish and roe. Now, it sounds like an infamous solicitor, doesn't it? Go to radish and roe, and they'll fix your problems. To take us through that, how does that...
Yeah, well, look, I mean, obviously, it's a sparkling wine, so I'll start with the roe. I mean, the roe is a bit of a pop, and it's a bit of a fun element there.
Yeah.
The radish itself is breakfast radish straight out of our estate garden.
Yes.
So we try and incorporate any particular sort of, herb or vegetable on most of the, whatever opportunity we can to do that.
Yep.
The yuzu, we're actually just changing the summer menu over, and that'll be kingfish with miso.
Oh, miso, yeah.
Yep. Mm. But the yuzu was there with the ocean trout, which has been slightly sugar cured, to give a almost like a bit of a fizz, because yuzu's got a little bit of a fizzy, sour, sweet, playful flavour, and it lingers. And that's why we thought that those particular flavours would go very well.
Is there a bit of river in the ocean trout? Because they say you can, you can't take the river out of ocean trout. It has that slight nuanced flavour. People confuse it with smoked salmon or salmon. It's a different, distinctive flavour, isn't it?
Yeah, we're using different versions of trout. There's actually a new trout we're using from New Zealand.
Oh, right.
That's icy waters from a volcanic mountain.
Yep.
But the local Tasmanian trout and salmon basically are hatched as teenagers.
Yep.
In the rivers, then they're moved to the large pots.
If the seals don't get them,
in deeper waters.
So, would ouzu be an umami flavour?
No, ouzu is more of a as I say, it's It's more of a sour, sweet, intense flavour that is best used with other ingredients, particularly seafood, mm-hmm. because obviously on its own it's a little bit too harsh.
Is it? Yeah. Is it true that the older you get, the more your palate accommodates the bitter flavours? Because we're all brought up on highly processed foods full of sugar and salt and that sort of thing. I notice as I'm getting older, my palate accommodates bitter better. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, for example, now you often go out, Brussels sprouts now are served in a whole new way. Not like we were when kids, they boil the life out of them. Mm. Is that true? Do you notice that when you're planning your menu?
Yeah, I do. Look, certainly there's always a bitterness, in most menus, which is okay to use. But isn't it funny, because I was at the races the other day in the mum tent.
Got to the mum tent.
And the word using bitterness as a flavour in champagne is, the bitterness is there.
Yes.
It's often not disclosed.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Well, I think in wine, I certainly use bitterness as a tool. We use the stalks as a component, quite a key. It's not the whole story, but it's a key component of the balance and lengthening out the palate. And certainly, the stemminess of the stalks, and indeed some varieties like Marsanna, as a white grape variety, they have an element of bitterness to them. And if you can get that in balance, it just brings almost a subliminal lengthening and finish on the palate, and that kind of reverberation and persistence of flavour.
Yeah, you're right with the Rhone whites, but no one drinks them, or they try and drink them as standalone and not food wines. I mean, Viognier, Roussanne, Massanne, Box Sarah Gough up at Box Grove makes some lovely wines. The Massanne up at Tobilk.
Mm-hmm.
Been underpriced for years, and people just guzzle it. Yep. Now they're coming to a new appreciation. Hey, they're food wines, guys. Take your time. You know, appreciate it. And this is what you're all about, isn't it? Exploring the nuances of rediscovering wine and food.
And thinking about them differently.
Yeah.
It's not just a standalone drink.
Yeah. Yeah. Would that be fair enough too?
Look, that's right. I mean, ever since we've had this experience at Levantine Hill, I mean, certainly that's changed my view, because every time I'm out or I'm trying a different wine, I'm always, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what food would go with this particular, you know, wine or this variety. So it does make you think, which is good.
So do you guys ever get a chance to get it? I was speaking to Jim Halliday the other day here, and he has, I think, a week or two weeks a year off where he doesn't talk about wine, doesn't drink wine, just goes away. And so you're so much into it, and you've been for a long while. How do you get away from it and refresh your mind and refresh your palates and come back to it again? Because it's a pretty long innings that you're in. It's pretty intense and it's pretty detailed. Teague, you're running a restaurant empire. You must have, how many staff do you have to look after? Paul, you're running a fairly complex thing. People think a winery is a lot of fun and all that. There's a lot of detail, a lot of work behind the scenes. And it can be pretty intensive. So how do you refresh yourselves? And you play music, don't you, Paul?
When I have time, yes.
Yeah. What do you do to get away from it? And
yeah, I tend to take short bursts of trips away. Yeah. Just to get away, see different people.
Yep.
Different restaurants. But certainly when I go away, I still love to eat.
Yeah.
That never stops.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. On to the next one. And I hope you enjoyed that white. I thought it was delicious. And the radish and roe. Oh, Now, the Estate Rosé. Now, take us quickly through that, Paul, and then Teague, you can talk about the food you've matched with it.
Sure. Okay, so the 2015 Levantine Hill Estate Rosé is a little bit kind of, it's straddling both sides of the Pyrenees in its...
Is it?
Yeah, in its genesis, sort of the idea behind it. So it's somewhere between the Provençal styles, but the more sort of full-bodied Rosanto styles of northern Spain.
Yes.
And it's a little bit left of centre for some modern Australian rosés in that it's based on Cabernet Sauvignon as the principal grape variety.
Yep.
So nearly three-quarters of the blend is derived from Cabernet Sauvignon. It's about 21% from memory of Pinot Noir, just to give it that little bit of perfume and finesse, and just kind of bring the boldness of the Cabernet Sauvignon into balance a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 0.2 of not much sort of 4% of Merlot and 1%, the all-important 1% of Petit Verdot.
Petit Verdot. Now, what's that you're sounding like? The great man at Yarra Yering there, yes. Use of
channeling.
Petit Verdot. Yeah, channeling, that's yes. Cool. That's it.
Yeah. With the Petit Verdot, I always found it's not a tremendously complex variety. You could say it's a bit one-dimensional, but, gee, it's one hell of a dimension. It's very, very exuberant in its expression of this quite distinct, almost framboise, raspberry character, but it also has this delicious little injection of natural acidity. So you might think 1% in a blend is you're just messing around, you're having a laugh, but 1% is in everything in life. You know, they're the most difficult things to get. You know, if you're changing things to change whole scale by 80 or 90%, that's the easiest part. It's the fine tuning of the final 5%.
You're sounding like William Downey here with his 1% of what's that wine he put out? 1,000 candles and had a bit of Sauv Blanc in it or something.
Yeah, I think it might have had more than 1%.
Yeah,
but that little injection of the Petit Verdot is actually very important for the balance.
Okay, now what are we going to eat with that?
Okay,
tea?
So what we're going to eat is with this rosé, we tend to use a seasonal approach.
Yeah.
So what we tend to do is use our estate garden to handpick seasonal things that might be in season. I find that generally with this particular dish, it's always a cold vegetable salad.
Yep.
And it'll have crunch, crumb, and have some cheese of some sort as a good contrast of textures.
Yep.
And I actually find that ricotta, we make our own house-made ricotta, and sometimes we put it. Smoke it a little bit, not too much, and incorporating that sort of flavour with things like, as Paul was saying, the sort of Spanish influence, jamón, could be Serrano.
Yep.
We make our own rye soil, which is like a dehydrated rye crumb.
Yep.
Black olives.
Yep.
At the moment,
Walnut
vinaigrette.
Yep.
So it's quite a complex dish, and sometimes we'll throw in some hazelnuts as well.
Yep.
So the dish is quite a play of different textures and flavours that really are about the cheese and the garden, which actually fit in really well with the rosé. In fact, I must say, it's probably one of my most exciting matches on the whole.
Really, that's the one that challenges you the most.
Yep.
Well, so it should, because rosés are coming of age now. I mean, rosés used to be not even on the radar in show judging, like sparkling. Now we're making some seriously good rosés. And I haven't tasted Paul's yet, but...
Well, I think we might be about to throw Teague and Sharna a bit of a curveball in that we're about to release a second rosé, so competing side by side. So one is the Cabernet Dominant one, but the one we're about to release is a Pinot Noir Shiraz Cabernet.
Oh, right.
So that will very much be pretty much focused on that dry Provençal style. So just something to think about, too.
Rose Kentish does a good... Alathorn, she does a good Provençal rosé. Rose. Now, we've got... next, we're moving on to... And this is a pretty fast taster or degustation, folks. I hope you're enjoying it, and I hope you're salivating, and I hope you get up there and try it, because there's no good talking about it. You've just got to try it among friends and enjoy it. And for heaven's sake, take your time. This is all about an experience that's time... And relax into it. Very important. Now, the next one is the Coldstream... Oh, and I like this, the pun. Who came up with Coldstream Guard? Is that not protected?
It might have been
you
me.
You might hear from might Her Majesty's me. Ordnance Office or something about that. The Coldstream... Coldstream Guard.
The barrel yet.
Albus. This is obviously a red...
No.
Oh, it's a white, Albus. Oh, well, there we go. What have I done sneaking a white in there? Tell us about it.
Well, generally, probably the evolution of the Yarra Valley in its second instance, I think, is really been driven by varietally labelled wines. So your Chardonnay, your Pinot Noir are probably the heroes.
Yep.
Shiraz increasingly so. But I think traditionally the wines that put the Yarra Valley on the map were predominantly Bordeaux blends or Cabernet-based blends. So we're just trying to bring, given that we're trying to look at food friendliness and food matching and that sort of thing, I think one of the greatest wine styles for doing that is blended wines, whether they're white or red.
Yep.
So taking that, we've just sort of done a little bit, kind of a cheeky blend of, it's Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay, Viognier and Semillon. So not something you'd find every day.
All in the same room. Yeah.
All in the same room, on the same page. But we think by trying to amplify the strengths of each of those individual varieties, they might sound a little bit kind of wacky.
How long did it take you to blend to get that right? Because that's a bit of a...
Well, I generally, when I'm blending, it's not something you'll just put on the bench and go, bang, there it is, and then you walk away and it's signed, sealed, delivered. It's something that I will mull over. It'll probably keep me awake at night, much like Teague's dreaming about food and food flavours and matches keep him awake at night. But, certainly I have a very important element in blending, which is called the back deck test.
Right.
Which is you'll knock up a blend in the lab. Yeah. And take it home and just see how it drinks on the back deck. And if it passes, then that's generally a green light. But no decision is finalised until almost ready to go to bottle. There's, there's one or two percent that can be...
It's fantastic. Now, seared scallops, I hear. Of course it's going to be a white. But scallops these days are very seasonal, aren't they? They're very problematic. Where do you source your scallops from? It's got to be in season.
Yeah, look, these scallops actually, these are Canadian scallops. So these are the ones that, and look, they are terrific quality, and we basically can get those all year round.
Yeah, that's why I use them, because otherwise you're at the mercy of the,
That's right.
Yeah. And cauliflower tofu, I believe.
So basically, so what that is, that's just a combination of cauliflower and tofu as a blend. And I think that, you know, look, and this is what I keep talking about our food, is that we like to have crunch and softness and just to have those contrasting textures. And sorrel, there's a we also make a sauce from sorrel and watercress, chives. So it's quite a vivacious and very aromatic ingredient that's not too strong, that complements the wine fantastically. And, of course, almonds are a very good complement there, not only for the dish, but also, too, in some aspects of the wine. So overall, I think that's a great dish for that match.
Guys, we're going to have you back because it's the end of the program. It's,
we haven't even got onto red.
No, we haven't even... Well, we did start with the red. That's why we started with the red. I thought I'd get you there. But look, time's up. Tempus fugit, as they say in the classics. Look, it's been... Look, thank you very much for coming in, and because I know you're both very busy people, for giving of your time and sharing. And it's a fascinating glimpse into the world of wine and food matching. I don't know about you at home, but gee, I'm salivating here because you're really getting excited about both the wine blends and the thought that's gone into the food. So I could thoroughly recommend getting up there and tasting it for yourself. Well, that's about it. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on all stations around Australia, via the Community Radio Network. And cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately. And thank you, Teague. Cheers.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you, Paul.
No worries, Michael. Thank you.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.